Thank you, Dr. Chairman. The Habitat Committee met jointly with the AP on the 22nd of January. I was very happy to see that all 10 committee members were there, and 10 of the 12 AP members were there, so we had a pretty full body. We had several tasks in front of us. We made several recommendations to the SSC regarding our research priorities. Mr. Ruccio was kind enough to give us a briefing on an unpublished EFP for the Great South Channel, which we can talk about as well. And we did have several topics of discussion for offshore wind and some policy development. So we'll go through the presentation, and we can stop at the appropriate time to take questions, if that's okay with you, Doctor.
Sounds great. We'll call on Mr. Hooker.
Thank you for the invitation to come in and give an update on offshore wind to the council. I'll start off today's presentation to just primarily give an overview of what the status is of several of our projects. So starting in the eastern side of the lease areas, we have what's termed Liberty Wind. It's a Vineyard Wind development project. Surveys are ongoing in that area. A COP is expected for that area in 2020. Moving to the west is the Mayflower project. A SAP was received in the fall of 2019, and the review for that site assessment plan is ongoing. And then to the west of that is another one of Equinor's lease areas, which was executed in March of 2019 at the same time as those other two. Moving still to the west, we have the Vineyard Wind project. We are beginning the supplemental EIS for that project. I'll touch base in more detail on that in a minute. We do anticipate a comment period for that supplemental EIS this spring, summer time period. The Vineyard Wind South area, I think that's part of the Park City project. Surveys are ongoing, and we anticipate a COP for that area in 2020 as well. Moving further to the west is an Ørsted project, the Bay State Wind project. Surveys for that are ongoing, and a COP was submitted in March 2019, and the COP review is still continuing. Still moving further to the west was the Sunrise Wind Farm project, also Ørsted. Surveys are ongoing, and a COP is anticipated for that in 2020 as well. Moving into that northern part of on the far western side is the South Fork Wind Farm. The COP has been submitted, scoping meetings have been held, and the draft environmental impact statement for that project is under development. And the Revolution Wind Farm, which is part of that same lease area, is also has surveys ongoing. Moving still further south, Empire Winds, which is Equinor project. The site assessment plan was approved and surveys are ongoing. I believe they're actually in the process of deploying the site assessment buoys, and a COP, the update to this slide, a COP has been received this month, and the review is just getting kicked off for that construction and operations plan for Empire Wind. Moving further south, the Atlantic Shores, which is a joint project between EDF and Shell, a site assessment plan was received in December, and the site assessment plan is ongoing. Ocean Wind is an Ørsted project. The SAP was approved in 2018. A COP was received in August 2019, and the review for that project is ongoing as well. We did receive an unsolicited application for a grid connection, purely a transmission project, and we published a request for competitive interest, and we're currently reviewing those comments and making determinations on that request under that competitive review. Quickly moving south from there, the Skipjack Wind Farm and the Norsted project. The construction operation plan is ongoing, and as well as some surveys are ongoing. We also have the U.S. Wind Marwin project. SAP was approved for a meteorological tower some time ago, although the meteorological tower has not been installed yet. The Coastal Virginia Offshore Wind Project, formerly known as VOWTAP, now CVOW, is a joint project between the state of Virginia, Ørsted, and Dominion Energy. And that one was a revised research activity plan. This is only for two turbines. And we do anticipate the construction of those turbines this spring and summer. So that will be the first project built in federal waters. So that's the only other project. Block Island Wind Farm was in state waters, as a reminder. And then for the larger commercial scale project in adjacent lease area off Virginia, only a site assessment plan has been approved. The further south lease area that we have, the Avangrid Kitty Hawk lease site assessment plan was submitted in September 2019, and our final review of that is almost complete. Surveys are ongoing there. So I'm going to pause just real quickly. All this information is a lot of information. I did just recently update the fishing industry webpage, which does link to the joint New England Council, Mid-Atlantic Council fishing webpage as well. So we are trying to really organize and keep up to date the information shared on those two sites. I hope that you are finding it useful. On that fishing industry webpage, not only is there a link to the actual maps and more project detail there, but also is the link to the all the fishery liaisons. So if you have specific questions about activities on a particular leasehold, it has the email and phone number for those individuals, many of whom are here in the audience today. I believe there's the fishery representatives from Ørsted, Equinor, and Vineyard Wind here as well. I think that's everybody. So I did want to take a little bit of time just to give you a brief update on where we are, some of our environmental studies that might be of interest. As you know, we do conduct a solicitation for study ideas every year. We just concluded the solicitation for 2021 ideas, and they're, you know, we're reviewing those and putting the ones we select will move forward into our studies development plan for 2021 through 2023. We are now in the process of trying to execute our FY 2020 studies that were previously approved, and I'll kind of walk through some of the ones that are being executed. One I know that is of interest to this council is another hydrodynamic modeling study. This one we'll be modeling three different particles, or in this case, larvae, life stages of basically three different fish or invertebrates and under four different offshore wind modeling scenarios. And it will focus in on that southern New England, mid-Atlantic bite area. We do appreciate the comments of council staff, both from Mid-Atlantic and New England Council and from GARFO and the Science Center on our requests for, you know, if there are any priorities for studying those three, which three species to study for that. Obviously, scallop was a high priority. The other two were... We forwarded the information on to the contractor and DHI and CSA to include in their desktop analysis of which one has the most information, and we'll have a kind of a science-based approach to identifying what other two particles and what other two larvae will be modeled under this this study, and that will result in a final report in the spring of 2021. This will be the second hydrodynamic study that we've funded. And I know, I think there's a scallop RSA one that's looking at this issue as well, in particular to scallop. The other one that's been of importance is a joint effort between the state of Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and BOEM Together, we were able to pool $1 million to put towards pilot regional fishery studies. The solicitation resulted in 19 proposals. The proposal review occurred back in December, and we got input from a steering committee, including the Northeast Fishery Science Center and GARFO. And then we anticipate final selection soon. So right now, those top awards are under review by the funding agencies, and we should be hoping to make an announcement soon on what those final selections will be. As a reminder, again, we had a few different topic areas. One was habitat, one was fisheries, and another one more of a socioeconomic aspect under those topic areas. Okay, the Coxledge fishery study is another one that we just launched. This one is based on a lot of work that was done on Stellwagen Bank using acoustic receivers, both VIMCO and just vocalizing animals to find cod spawning aggregations. And this one is focused more on the Coxledge area in southern New England. It will include up to 25 bottom mounted acoustic telemetry receivers, as well as the glider work. And what you're seeing here is the glider work is actually doing, whenever it's deployed, it has real-time detections that you can go onto the HUI webpage and look at what it's detecting. Obviously, in addition to detecting VIMCO tags, they are listening for vocalizing right whales and other vocalizing marine mammals as well. All right, that concludes what was loaded up. There was another version of this that I did send. I guess that we didn't get it up, but I was going to talk a little bit more about the Vineyard Wind SEIS real quickly, where we are. I mentioned that we do anticipate a 45-day public comment period this summer. The primary thing I want the slide that I had included, I think it may be the slide, maybe it's in your briefing book, showed this inverted triangle. It showed what the big jump that we're making in the SEIS is. To keep in mind, this is not a programmatic SEIS. This will not be evaluating the offshore renewable energy program as a whole. Instead, it will... What it's doing is looking at the cumulative effect of multiple projects. And so what happened is we expanded the reasonable foreseeable scenario to include, I think, every single lease area. So every lease area that we currently have will be under that cumulative impact scenario. And we've tried to identify what spots in time where those projects will come online and how they will have the incremental effect in synergy with the Vineyard Wind project. So it's a much larger scope than that Tier 1 and Tier 2 project. When for Southern New England in particular, we were just looking at the only contiguous projects were really Bay State and Vineyard. Now we're looking at that entire area as a whole. And I know of interest to many people, as a result of us looking at that whole area, the navigational risk assessment will look a little bit different. As you know, there's been several proposals out there for different uniform layouts. That will be a part of the SEIS as well. And I think many people are aware that the Mary Parr's study that the Coast Guard conducted is publishing this week. The notice of the study availability, I think, is in the reading room at the Federal Register, and I believe once that publishes, that docket will have the link to the full report. So again, that's a different scope, especially affecting the contiguous areas in southern New England. I think that's all I had. I'll stop there for questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hooker. We'll start with questions from the council first. Yes.
you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Brian, my question is just on the Cox Ledge fisheries study. That the glider work, is that done monthly?
I'd have to actually go back and check. I can't remember what the sampling frequency is on when the glider deployment is. Obviously the moored ones are out there continuously. The glider work, I'd have to go back and check on what the deployment frequency. I don't remember without my head.
Any other questions from the council on the presentation? Mr. Bellavance.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian, for your presentation. I do have that SCIS cumulative impact slide in my presentation, and I'm still not clear what's going to happen to it, or like what are you doing with it? Like, how is that going to be presented? Or I guess I'm just confused by it all. Maybe it's because it's a busy slide, but what's the overall goal?
The cumulative scenario just now includes a much larger grouping of projects, and that's what that slide is trying to convey, is that it's now looking at every single area that we've leased will be part of that cumulative impact scenario, whereas in the DEIS there was a much more limited projects where we said only if a COP was received or anticipated to be received would it be considered in that cumulative impact scenario. Now what we've said, that we've raised the tier up to all projects that are promised by different states, like meeting, what meets all the different state procurement goals with the available lease areas. So that's the difference. Now, how that plays with different resources depends on which resource area you're talking about. So for fisheries, where we're looking at things coastwide, they will be a cumulative effect on fisheries operations because they operate, along that whole area. Whereas potentially, this is the Habitat Committee readout. The Habitat wouldn't necessarily be that whole area, because you're looking at the cumulative effect of the Vineyard Wind project on and the effect of adjacent habitats, because the habitat doesn't extend to the entire shelf, or the affected habitat isn't affected to the entire shelf. So it depends on what that footprint is on whatever resource you're talking about as to whether or not you'll see a big difference in the analysis. But bottom line is that it does have a much larger cumulative scenario.
Dr. Sissonwine, then Mr. Alexander.
Yes, thank you. I'm curious about the studies that are going on looking at hydrodynamic models to address larval drift or ichthyoplankton drift, eggs and larvae. There have been many such studies done in the past. Many of them were done a long time ago to look at drift as it related to nuclear power plants and how they would entrain larvae and kill them and so forth, which made a lot of sense. It's unclear to me in this case what the objective is. I'm assuming that a windmill doesn't necessarily kill larvae as it drifts by. So what are we trying to find out by these studies?
I think the simple answer is looking at, what does that do to the movement of larvae through the system? I know for sea scallops, it was, it's always been a concern over, spawning on George's Bank and then seeding areas in the mid-Atlantic, and how how the placement of turbines there could affect the advection of larvae from George's Bank to other areas in the mid-Atlantic bite. That's generally, I think, the type of thing we're looking at is from known spawning areas, wherever you're, releasing that larvae, into where you want that larvae to eventually settle out, what does the presence of those wind turbines do to that evection of larvae?
So the modeling is actually taking account of the physical presence of the turbines and how it changes circulation on the continental shelf.
That's correct, yes.
Which is probably a much bigger issue than just the larvae, but okay, thank you.
Mr. Alexander.
Yeah, just wonder if that effects thing you're working on that Mr. Bellavance mentioned is going to take into consideration the future work in the Gulf of Maine. Is that going to be in there?
No, it does not currently consider the Gulf of Maine or the New York Bight planning areas. Those are still two too far advanced, too far unknown before to be considered as reasonably foreseeable.
Mr. Hughes.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. My question is while you're on this slide, this is 17 gigawatts that's going to generate or going to have an estimated 1,662 foundations associated with the 17 gigawatts. I'm wondering, what are the state's ambitions right now? It's much larger than 17 gigawatts. I mean, New Jersey itself, I believe, is proposing 2,300 gigawatts. And overall, with the current technology, with the halide X that's out there, how many foundations would that equate to?
So your question again is, there are other project goals out there that, you know, may exceed this this scenario, but what we're limited to, and I think I think it's that third or fourth bullet there, it says, you know, all leased areas with no associated projects will be assumed to be built out to the extent necessary for nearby states. So there is some unmet demand under this scenario, but there's no place to put that unmet demand. Does that make sense? So the demand is currently greater than what this reasonably foreseeable scenario is, because we just don't have any place to put all that speculative demand in the water. Does that make sense?
Steve Hughes.
Thank you. It does. But I guess my point is we're looking at, you know, over 1,500 turbines with 17 gigawatts. Like I said, I think it's New Jersey's ambition to have 2,300 gigawatts. I'm sorry. So it's going to be a picket fence out there. And if you go back to one of your previous slides, and if you just do the two southern sites, you know, the ports that are impacted are Hampton Roads, Virginia, because scallop boats have to go inside the Delaware Bay to get off the clock. It's Cape May, it's Wildwood, it's Atlantic City, it's Sea Isle, and it's Barnegat Light. And that's what people have to understand about why it's so important that we have these transit lanes built into these. And right now, I don't believe that anybody has transit lanes built into their proposals. And I know that Rota has been supportive in holding a number of workshops, but that the developers don't necessarily have to listen to that advice that they're hearing. And I believe that you'd receive comments from Rota on some transit lanes. And I would just hope that BOEM would take very seriously the effect that we are creating this giant picket fence 12 to 15 miles off the coasts of all of New Jersey and almost all of New York. And all of those fishing communities need to be able to, number one, rationalize the thought that they're going to lose fishing grounds, understand that they're going to lose the available surveys that have historically taken place in those identified wind energy areas, and be able to wrap their heads around how are they going to get through this to get where they can continue to fish. So I would just hope that BOEM would take very seriously the fact that, you know, this only represents 17 gigawatts. New Jersey alone wants 2,300 gigawatts. That's what they're asking for. That doesn't include New York's, because I don't have that off the top of my head. So I would hope that you would take that into consideration. Thank you.
Soka?
Just a quick response to, yes, regarding the letter from Rota requesting BOEM consider an alternative in the SEIS that includes the one nautical mile spacing and transit corridors. We are currently considering that alternative. Obviously, a large piece of that is the Mary Parr's report, which I think we are all still, well, we haven't actually seen the full report, I don't think, yet, just the notice that it's going to be published this week. So I think we're still in the process of digesting how all that will play in into the SEIS. And the Mary Parts report, I think, does have a comment period associated with it, as well as does the SEIS. So we'll work with you on on that to the extent that we can to incorporate into the SEIS those comments. Thank you.
We're going to go out to the audience for any comments. This is just an update of the council. We're not going to have a full-blown debate on when there's days and weeks and months of conferences on that. So we're just kind of an update. But with that, Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I have a question. I think it's probably more directed at Dr. Hare than Brian here. The Cox's Ledge Fisheries Survey, and specifically the cod that exists there, what substock of cod are we talking about there? Are we talking Gulf of Maine cod? Because there is evidence that genetic evidence that's where those fish are from, or are they George's West, or which cod stock would that be impacting?
It's an excellent question. The Atlantic Cod Stock Structure Working Group is working on that presently, and I'm not sure. I can find out when they expect to have their report on cod stock structure in the Northeast U.S. continental shelf. But it's an excellent question. The Stock Structure Working Group has been looking at it for a year and a half, 2 years, and their report will be available this spring.
All right, thank you.
Anybody else from the audience? Seeing none, final word, Mr. Hoka?
Nope. Thank you very much. And Jim, thank you for your service.
Turn it back over to Habitat Chair, Mr. Reed.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Chairman. Put your attention on document 2B, which is the meeting summary. We have three motions that are headed at the SSC, but we also have two additional, one and a half additional motions, and some of those are directed at Mr. Hooker. So once we get through Michelle's presentation, maybe we can be kind enough to have Mr. Hooker take a few more questions if you're okay with that.
That's fine. And before we start the next presentation, I just want to welcome Lisa Cota Robles from Governor Sununu's office in New Hampshire. She's here to watch and participate. She's the Deputy Director of the State's Office of Strategic Initiatives and the State Energy Program Administrator. Welcome. Chairman Reed.
Ms. Bachman.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. I'm happy to be here on a Tuesday and not a Thursday this meeting. I'm going to cover a few different topics. A few different topics, starting with offshore wind-related matters, sort of bridging from Brian's presentation and then moving into some other work of the Habitat Committee, including a discussion we had on research priorities, which Eric mentioned. I've been working on developing these non-fishing policies, as well as we'll wrap up with a discussion of the EFP that, as Eric mentioned, Mike briefed us on at the meeting last week. So Brian and I sort of split up the offshore wind topics and decided I'd cover the Gulf of Maine Task Force meeting, although certainly you can take questions on this as well, and a number of you were there a little over a month ago in Durham. That was really well attended. There's task force members are sort of governmental members. There are 76 different task force members from various levels of, regional, state, local, federal government. 174 members of the public. I'd note that we're not a task force member. We have been asked, to be involved and provide input and advice as needed, and we'll see sort of how that process works over time. We were asked to speak about sort of the scope of fisheries in the Gulf of Maine and the work of the council. And so Tom gave a presentation. You can watch the video. You can also download the slides online if you're interested in doing that. Just in terms of the scope of the whole meeting, there were presentations on the leasing process overall. I think a lot of people at the meeting were probably new to the BOEM process. Obviously, many of us have been sort of working on this for years now. Roles of different bodies, some initiatives underway at the state level. All the states gave, I think, some really interesting talks about sort of where they're going and some of their goals. And then sources of information research was kind of the afternoon of the meeting. This is a diagram that it's a little small. You can grab it off of the website as well. There's a link at the bottom. But just sort of thinking about how the planning for offshore wind will work in the Gulf of Maine and how it's worked in other areas generally is that there's it kind of winnows down from this planning area to a RFI as a request for interest or information.
Request for interest.
Are developers interested in developing that area? A call area, which is further, more specific, and that's a required step. And then the wind energy areas, and the leases come out of those wind energy areas. So it is designed to be sort of this bigger to smaller planning process over time. And there was discussion of how that process worked and general support for sort of taking it all the way through the process. We talked about this at the Habitat Committee Advisory Panel meeting last week as well. So a lot of these issues, I literally stole these bullets directly from the BOEM summary. So thank you to whoever at BOEM drafted that. It was very helpful. What's the timing was a big question, kind of when is this going to happen and how quickly and what's the role in of everybody in the process. There's definitely some discussion about offshore transmission networks. Brian alluded to the proposal that for the Mid-Atlantic region, so something like that, the coordinated transmission. Also, there's going to be infrastructure needs onshore and kind of how these projects connect into the grid. Aesthetic considerations, so can you see the turbines from coastal areas? Coordination between the state and BOEM processes, workforce development, the desire and maximizing local jobs. There's a lot of discussion, especially amongst the members of the public that attended, supporting offshore wind power in a general sense to address climate change impacts. And just really this sense of, a desire for regional leadership and floating technology, which is sort of emerging. So there was quite a bit of discussion about fisheries, concerns raised from commercial fishermen about the impacts of wind farms on their activities. A specific concern that was raised, as opposed to fixed arrays, which, have a certain spacing and buried cables, that floating arrays with different mooring lines and the cables that are running between the turbines to connect them to each other, that would make fishing very, very difficult, if not impossible. So there wasn't a lot of unpacking of that issue, and there was limited discussion of what floating technology actually looks like. There was interest in looking into that in more detail at a follow-up task force meeting, but that was a point that was raised. There's definitely a desire expressed amongst fisheries constituents to be involved in the process, a sense that should be engaged early and often, have an inclusive participatory siting process. There was reference made to various European wind farms and making sure that we're learning from those experiences, promoting the sort of research capacity in the New England region and outside it to learn and sort of develop some best management practices. And as I mentioned, we did talk about this last week, kind of what's the best approach for the council to engage in this issue. And so you can see that discussion in the meeting summary. This is just to give kind of a sense of scale of, for example, the Mass, Rhode Island wind energy areas, lease areas, you can see in blue compared to some of our fishery management areas in the Gulf of Maine. So you're talking about, similar scales of thousands of square kilometers each. But, I think we'll sort of continue looking at these issues of location and scale as we move forward here. But, for the task force purposes, it's very early stages yet. So now I'm going to give you a disclaimer that I'm not an engineer. I'm not an expert on floating wind technology. I think there are probably quite a few folks in the region who are, and it might be interesting to have some of them come speak to the committee and or the council at some point. But just to put a few kind of general points out there and give you a sense of what's going on worldwide with this technology, it's definitely more emerging. The turbines that are being used and installed in some of the more pilot projects for floating are smaller than the turbines that are being used for these commercial projects, but it, I think, is catching up. It is more expensive presently, but it's my reading, that's partly a supply chain issue, and as you know, this is scaled up, the cost should come down. And the big difference with floating as opposed to fixed is you can use it in much deeper areas, which if you look at a wind map of our region, the further out, you know, we go further offshore, it gets windier. And the fixed structures are generally used to about 60 meters, and beyond that, it gets just, for an engineering and cost purposes, somewhat infeasible. So at least some of these, I believe the Equinor turbine, for example, you can use to 1,000 meters. So it really opens up a lot of different areas. Trade-offs with access and things like that, but certainly less invasive to the seabed during installation. So there's a couple different designs, and the ones that are currently being tested, I think, are all the SPAR or the semi-sub, the semi-submersible designs. And so you can see just a couple of examples, and this is not to scale in terms of the mooring lines, I think are probably both longer and further away from the base than what this diagram is showing you, but you can get a sense of some of the different foundation types that are being looked at. So just some example projects that you may have heard of. In Scotland, there's this Highwind Pilot Park. This is an Equinor Masdar project. The turbine is called Highwind, and so the Highwind Scotland uses the Highwind turbine in Scotland, and that was engineered by Equinor. They previously have tested this design off of Norway, a smaller with a smaller turbine, I believe. So this is, again, that SPAR style. So you see on the left of this one, this previous figure. So the pilot park has 5-6 megawatt turbines. So there's about actually the same scale as the Block Island wind farm, or almost exactly the same. The total area of the wind farm is about 4 square kilometers, and the depths are somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 meters. And it has been operational since, I think, the fall of 2017. This is maybe a better way of kind of looking at the site. You can see sort of how the turbines are laid out and then the mooring lines. These have 3 mooring lines each, and then the orange are the sort of cables that are connecting between the turbines. So they're chained together, and then there's obviously an export cable, which is mostly off the screen. Other examples of floating offshore wind, in offshore Maine, there's off Monhegan, there's this deep water offshore wind test site. And so that site has been set up to allow 2 different turbines and an export cable. There's a prototype that's been deployed for a while. I'm not sure exactly when off the top of my head. The turbines at this test site haven't been deployed yet. They've done a lot of science, which I didn't realize until I sort of started looking into this a few days ago, and there's a link there if you want to check that out. And then the design actually of the turbine itself is a semi-submersible hull with the 3 mooring lines. And that's developed by Maine Aquaventus. And so they're leading this demonstration of the Aquaventus turbine. So this is something that's right in our region and is continuing development. There's probably people here that are more familiar with this project than me. And then another sort of recently kind of in the works project is a wind, and this is another design, is a wind float Atlantic. So wind float is the foundation. And then they're just putting, I think, the MHI Vestas is pretty typical turbine that's used in a bunch of different projects. So this is an EDP, Renovavis, NG, and Ripsol project. And the Principal Power is the designer of the Wind Float Foundation. Their website is actually quite interesting, and you can sort of in 3D look at how the wind float, the different components of the turbine would work, or the foundation and the turbine together. So if you want to check that out. This turbine installed is it's the largest floating turbine operational present. Similar site depth to the Highwind project, and I think to the Monhegan project too. Eventually they're looking at having 3 turbines for this project with a 25 megawatt total capacity. And they started transmitting power from that first turbine just this month. So moving on, unless people have questions about the engineering that I don't understand, or the Gulf of Maine task force.
We'll stop for some questions on the presentation at this point.
Okay.
Seeing none, out to the audience, seeing none.
Okay, so I'll roll through the rest of the slides and then we can have a discussion after that. RODA's been quite active, and I assume Dr. Hogan can answer questions on some of these initiatives if needed. But Annie provided me a number of updates. They're starting up their West Coast Committee, and they have several members of that kind of trying to share expertise and best practices and strategies. They had a joint industry task force meeting earlier in the month, and then they had a couple of layout workshops partnering with Equinor and Ørsted. And we talked about these at the advisory panel committee meeting last week, and apparently the format was really effective, and they felt like they got a lot of good feedback and were able to look at adjustments to designs sort of on the fly about, you know, kind of how the arrays might be set up and you know, how you would move between them and transit questions and things like that. So those, I guess, were productive, and those happened just a few weeks ago. They are looking at sort of a bigger sense at transit in the New York Bight, and so there is a survey that's linked, and it's on the Offshore Wind Joint Council webpage as well, and so welcome to respond to that if you haven't already and you're interested. For the last, I guess it's been almost a year, maybe a little longer, they've been working on this Fishing Industry Knowledge Trust project. So fishermen, you know, are on the water routinely collecting different types of environmental data or taking their sort of fishing effort location data and putting that into some kind of format that they could collectively use and then potentially share. And so that project is funded and is underway. There's going to be a discussion after this about the data portals and the fishing effort updates, and Rota's partnering on that with the data portal groups. I think people are aware that at the Fisherman's Forum, there's going to be an offshore wind event on the Thursday of the forum. I'll be attending, and Rota's participating as well, and a number of others. So that should be, I think, a really helpful day for people who are in the Gulf of Maine, not really familiar with these issues yet. There's some Jones Act changes that if you are interested in that issue, there's a link there. And then Rota did comment to BOEM on lighting and marking of wind turbines. We sent a letter to that you should have seen maybe 6 or 8 weeks ago. My sense of time is hazy. So this slide is obviously out of date because Brian covered this, but you can grab the Federal Register notice, the inspection version off the Federal Register site now, and the report should be available tomorrow. But I guess these two other proposals, Rota's transit lane proposal, as well as the developers in the region proposed a uniform 1 mile spacing grid. So both of those were put out in the last 6 to 8 weeks. And so the PAR study does reflect on those proposals. They, I think, are linked in the docket, but they're linked here as well separately. The notice does request comments on the study and whether the findings of the study are appropriate. So I guess it's a question for the council if we would want to consider submitting comments. We did write comments in response to the original solicitation, which should be on the Joint Wind webpage and also on our nefmc.org if anyone wants to look at what we previously said. So in terms of other Habitat Committee work, we had a discussion of research priorities. And so really, there's a couple stages to this. The plan development team looked at the list of research priorities related to habitat and related to offshore wind. And in some cases, some of the priorities sort of intersect both. PDT mostly identified studies that are ongoing that are related. And then the committee and the advisors talked about this, and there was a handful of motions at the meeting last week that indicate suggested edits, and we'll provide those to the SSC for their review later in the spring. In some cases, you know, issues of timing, something being strategic or essential, these are all 5-year research priorities, but sort of nearer or further in that horizon. We had a motion about adding an intent to look at seasonal changes in habitat or fish resources, and that really applied to a number of different priorities that envision different surveys and data collection. in some cases, floating wind was less on our radar as we drafted these priorities last year, and now that it's sort of more of an emerging issue, we just wanted to flag that and be explicit about that with respect to a couple of the different priorities. And then in some cases, we, I think, either the sort of spatial scope of a particular priority might have been implied to be Southern New England, Mid-Atlantic, and the group last week felt that it was important to call out that those would be important efforts for the Gulf of Maine as well, given emerging issues there. So we'll provide those issues via Rachel to the SSC for their discussion later in the spring. So one thing that we talked about in quite a bit of detail, and this we started this conversation, I guess, and back in April of last year in Mystic, but the notion that the Fisheries Science Center's fishery independent surveys are going to be affected by the installation of offshore wind farms and what, as sort of a region and as a science enterprise, has done about that. And so the way that the priority is currently drafted, it was sort of limited to fishery independent surveys done by the Science Center with a focus on that Southern New England, Mid-Atlantic region. The committee wanted to suggest kind of expanding on that priority, making sure it applies in the Gulf of Maine down the road as well, and also indicating that it's not just the fishery independent surveys, it's the methods for those surveys, and fishery data coming out of those areas is going to change too as fisheries change in response to installation of wind turbines. So all of that, you know, may impact the assessment process and the results of that and catch advice and have these knock-on socioeconomic impacts. So the suggestion was to sort of expand upon this priority in this way. So this is an issue that the Science Center is looking at. You know, I think I'm certain they could use more resources to really dig into this issue. And I think the committee and the advisory panel last week appreciated sort of the scale of the problem. But this is something we talked about quite a bit. Something else that's kind of going on in the offshore wind space with respect to NIMS and potentially the, you know, council being a little bit involved is the benthic surveys that are being done when studying these offshore wind lease areas prior to development of the construction operations plan and design of the wind farms. And the back and forth that NIMS has had with developers and with BOEM is that a lot of the geological sampling that's done for the purposes of engineering isn't really providing the level of information that lets the agency, that lets a full EFH assessment be written. There's not the level of data about habitat at the sort of fine scales and looking at the habitat features that we need to really understand what are the effects on EFH going to be. These are, you know, primarily sort of geologic engineering type of surveys. And so NIFS has been working with BOEM and other partners and some of the contractors and such to flesh out some enhanced guidelines for this type of habitat, more habitat surveys than geological surveys. And so there's some guidance that's in the works and should be made public quite soon that the service has developed. So just to make you aware that this is an active area of work. And so the discussion at the meeting last week with respect to the research priorities was that, you know, these types of surveys should really be done in a way that gives us EFH information. And so this relates specifically to one of the priorities on the list. And then the other sort of related issue is about kind of when you're doing these surveys related to the design of the arrays and, you know, this notion that it would be better to sort of fully do a habitat survey of an area earlier on in the process, that you really understand some of the trade-offs with respect to fish habitat versus where you might place turbines, and that you can do that in sort of a comprehensive way at the outset. And so this is a motion that I think we can bring up later for discussion. And I think we're sort of trying to understand exactly what different developers are doing with respect to sampling some of these areas, but you know, potentially you could be doing relatively narrow sampling in areas where you're looking at putting foundations and things, and you're not developing a sort of comprehensive habitat map at the scales that would be useful for understanding impacts to EFH. And so that's kind of what this motion was about. Just to talk about briefly another activity of the committee. We have a priority for this year to develop habitat policies related to non-fishing impacts. And so we've got three topics: floating offshore wind as to augment our existing offshore wind policy, aquaculture, and submarine cables. And so this is really the focused on the habitat and direct kind of resource impacts of these activities. But a first step is to figure out what do we know about these activities, kind of what's going on with them in the region, and sort of summarizing the activity and the sort of state of science on impacts to habitat, direct impacts to marine resources that are managed by the council. And then once we sort of understand what those are, then we can start to write up these actual policies with these best management practices. And so we're in the through the PDT and through some others involved in the committee and the advisory panel, we're working on developing these background documents, gathering information, et cetera. And the idea is that these will be 10-page-ish or less documents that are a really high-level overview that let you participate fully in the process, provide links to additional information, et cetera. A lot of the related, you know, writing about these types of impacts and best management practices has already been done in various arenas, and so we're not sort of starting from scratch here. Certainly we'll pull in other experts as needed. So we drafted up these outlines. They're really skeletal at this point, but they just have a, and this is based on the work that the Mid-Atlantic did that was similar when they did these backgrounders for the activities they looked at a few years ago. But basically an overview of the activity, potential impacts to habitat, potential impacts to managed resources, and then just briefly kind of how does this activity interact with other activities in the coastal marine environment, potentially including fishing. And so we'll keep gathering resources. We're going to actually start drafting some of these sections. I did get some hands raised at the PDT, people willing to work on this. And then there's others, I think, that we can tap to work on these as well. We'll review them internally, talk about them with the advisory panel and committee, and then we'll do some kind of a educational briefing, whatever that will look like. And then later in the year, I think we'll start writing. So this is just kind of happening in the background when I'm not working on other things. And then finally, this is in the order, actually, that we talked about these things at the meeting last week, but to wrap up here, because this is an item that I think the council may want to comment on, is this exempted fishing permit discussion that we had. And so you, I think in your binders should have the Federal Register notice that NIMS has published on what aspects of what they would be authorizing under this EFP. And then there's a comment period that's open until February 11th. I think it's a Tuesday. And then there's also the application that Coonamessett Farm Foundation submitted to NIMS with the sort of design of the study. So it includes not only the work that's envisioned as part of the Federal Register notice that was published, but additional work that would be sort of a second phase of the project as well. So there's been a lot of back and forth that I've only been a little involved with between Coonamessett and NIMS staff at Garfo to scale the project and identify a sort of phase one sampling area and objectives for phase one. So we talked a lot about this last week and developed some comments, which you see on the following slides. And so I guess the question for the council is, do you want us to provide any specific comments in response to the Federal Register notice? We sometimes comment on EFPs if there are concerns or issues, and sometimes not. So we have a couple weeks to work on that. Just as a reminder, this is the Great South Channel Habitat Management Area, and the areas of interest to Coonamessett from an EFP perspective were the two black hatched ones, Rosen Crown, the larger to the west, and Davis Bank east, the smaller area. And then the others are the candidate exemption areas that the council's proposed that we're waiting on that final rulemaking for. So, and hopefully you recall that we adopted a range of research objectives for work done in the HMA that was back in June of last year. So improving our understanding of the distribution of habitat features, habitat stability and epifaunal persistence in relation to substrate type, tidal flows and storm events, sort of unpacking, you know, how these areas are affected and by what, improve our understanding of vulnerability to mussel and clam dredges, both susceptibility and recovery rates, and why is the area important to manage species, for example, cod. And so those are, you know, what the council is hoping to get out of research the CFP or other projects. And then this is the chart from the Federal Register notice. It just gives you a look at the Rose and Crown and the Davis Bank East areas, the hatching or the subsets of those areas that Coonamessett Farm Foundation originally proposed as they would like access to under the EFP to do the work that's suggested in the proposal. After much back and forth with NIMFS, they and the blue area with the red reference areas within it is what went out in the Federal Register notice. So under the FR notice that's published, they would issue, NIMFS would issue an EFP allowing vessels to work just in that blue area as kind of a phase one approach. And then the focus of that phase one portion of the study would really be on dredge mounted camera work and analysis of the video collected. Plus they're going to enumerate the catch and the dredge as well. And depending on, you know, funding and things like that, they may be able to do some dredge independent sampling in the reference areas as well. So there are a number of points on this raised during last week's meeting. These aren't consensus statements. They're just kind of points from the discussion. You can read the whole discussion in more detail in the meeting summary. We can certainly take any of these points or expand on any of them if we write a comment letter. Mr. Ruccio posed a couple questions to the group last week that may be useful for the discussion here. So is the work proposed during this phase one and published, you know, in the notice appropriate in terms of scale? Does the approach generally make sense? Is it responsive to the research requests of the council? So the questions from a few slides back, is it likely to be valuable to the council? So these are some of the points that we talked about. So there's this kind of balancing of impacts to habitat with desire to learn. And so, you know, in that balancing act, scaled back the area that was originally proposed. And so what's published is this revised study area, and it is relatively small. There was questions raised about how extensive the resource is within the area, so how many trips and tows would be productive. Generally, EFPs are issued for a year. You know, would this fishing activity continue to be productive for that entire year? And if the area is no longer productive and they're not, you know, able to generate funds and it doesn't make sense to keep gathering this camera, dredge-mounted camera data, then what? Is there, you know, this desire to shift the area that's exempted or expand that area? How should that process work? Should it, you know, should NIFS sort of start the Federal Register process again and take a new area out for comment? If there's just minor adjustments and there's been limited activity, maybe NIFS should just expand the area. And so there weren't any decisions, I don't think, made on how that should go, but certainly looking for feedback if the council has any on what that process might look like. So we definitely acknowledge that there are certainly data gaps with respect to our knowledge of habitats within the HMA. There's been some work. You know, some of the data is not particularly recent. You know, some areas have a finer spatial resolution of data, and some areas we have less information. So there's certainly more that we would like to know. And it was acknowledged that in some cases, just, you know, based on the availability of funding and et cetera, that EFPs are the only practical way to obtain information. And it is important to try and continue to learn about our habitat management areas. Also acknowledge that the HMA is vulnerable to the effects of clam dredging and that precaution is totally reasonable on the part of the service when issuing the EFP. So, you know, it seems like this phase one and sort of pilot approach that's proposed in the notice is an attempt to balance these considerations. And it's not going to address our entire list of research objectives, but perhaps a starting point. We talked a little bit about the sort of sampling protocol and information that'd be gathered and some of the sort of restrictions that would be on the EFP. The goal of the researchers is to collect video data during all tows in the area, but they probably put some kind of a performance metric in the final permit if issued, like 75% of tows, just to allow for the fact that sometimes you have issues, logistical issues at sea with video gear. And then the intent, this was, I don't think this is in the FR notice, but was asked at the meeting. We have this, enhanced VMS ping rate of every 5 minutes that was proposed in the framework, and the intent would be that that would be applied here as well, rather than the hourly or half hourly, depending on which other kind of permit requirement you have. So that was an intent. There was a discussion about making sure that everything that's caught in the dredge